I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Hillary Clinton was able to fend off a challenge from Bernie Sanders this past weekend in Nevada, where she won over almost 53% of the caucus goers. It was a must-win contest after her shellacking in New Hampshire. Meanwhile, in South Carolina this weekend, Donald Trump won more than 32% of the primary vote, further cementing his status as the GOP's presidential frontrunner. This was in spite of a rocky week when, among other things, he got into a religious tussle with Pope Francis. Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz were pretty much tied for the number two spot in South Carolina, and Jeb Bush called it quits after another lackluster showing. The Democrats move on to South Carolina this weekend for their primary. The Republicans have their caucus in Nevada tomorrow, and then next week it's Super Tuesday. Today in Radio Times, what to make of the 2016 race for the White House so far. And we have three guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Dick Pullman, national political columnist at Newsworks.org, where he writes the National Interest blog. He's also a full-time writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is John Brabender, chief creative officer of Brabender Cox, and that's a Republican consulting firm whose clients have included Rick Santorum, Tom Coburn, and Rudy Giuliani. John Brabender, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Scott Huffman. He's political science professor at Winthrop University and director of the Winthrop Poll, and that is in South Carolina. And Scott Huffman, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dick, let me begin with you, and actually for all of our guests and listeners as well, just a couple of questions about what happened in Nevada on Saturday, Dick, where Hillary Clinton won by about 5 to 6 points, mm-hmm. Points when it comes to caucus goers. What do you think her win, her victory, means for her candidacy?
Well, I think it smooths her path toward the nomination a bit. You almost have to look at what would have happened if she had lost. If she had lost Nevada, which was the first state with sort of a racially diverse electorate to vote, if she'd lost Nevada, we would be facing right now a full week of "Is Hillary in crisis?" Stories in the press leading into the South Carolina Democratic primary next Saturday. And also maybe it might have sort of shaken the nerves of some of the superdelegates, delegates who can vote for whoever they want, most of whom have been the ones who have declared pledged for her. So then there'd be all this thing about, well, maybe the superdelegates should be like holding back and reflecting more of the mood of the electorate. But the fact is none of that happened. The main thing that it did is, increase the odds, lower the odds that Bernie Sanders can perhaps win the nomination. I mean, he's had to prove that he can move beyond, I guess you'd almost say, a young white liberal base like he had in Iowa and New Hampshire. And this was the first test, and he failed it. Non-white voters voted pretty decisively for Hillary in this caucus, and now we're heading into South Carolina and a number of big states on March 1st, which have racially diverse electorates, and I think she's fairly well positioned.
Let me go to you, John, and there is a Republican caucus in Nevada tomorrow, pretty much on the heels of South Carolina. First of all, what do you make of this whole caucus process? I was watching a little bit of what was happening in Nevada over the weekend on TV, and it seems almost nonsensical. What do you make of the caucus system?
Well, it is nonsensical in some sense. I mean, you take, for example, Iowa, which we're all familiar with. It's not your typical electorate. They have a tendency to be more conservative and so forth. In Nevada, it's much different there. Last time, in a very close race, Mitt Romney won, but there's actually a significant Mormon population out there. And oftentimes, Tea Party candidates do very well, thus the rise of, say, a Sharon Engel in the Senate race there in 2010. And so what you find are they're very unpredictable, they're very volatile, and they're very hard to pull. Plus, it looks more and more like we're now down to 3 Republican candidates. And so what hasn't been factored in is where are some of these votes going to start going when you have, for example, a Jeb Bush now gone. You have Carson, who's not gone but has become insignificant to some degree, where his voters go. So they're very hard to predict. They're more about turnout than anything else. And I don't think Nevada is getting quite the attention it did last time because everybody sees the, March 1st date coming up with so many elections on that night that people know that that's going to be the critical test for all these candidates.
John, with everything that you said there, though, do you think that Trump will prevail in Nevada tomorrow?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, one of the advantages that Trump has is even though it's not an official organization, they have the ability to play in a lot of states at one time. If you look at a Marco Rubio, by way of example, he does not have the infrastructure to be able to do that. So he had to concentrate on South Carolina, and it paid dividends for him. Coming in second in South Carolina was huge for their campaign. Bush getting out was huge for Rubio as well, because a lot of those people are going to move there, including the money people. But people like Trump, where he already has these passionate supporters all around the country, all he has to do is make sure that they actually show up and vote. In Iowa, he was not successful at that. In New Hampshire, he was, and it makes a big difference.
Well, Scott, let me get you in on the conversation. I'm assuming the TV sets are all quiet now in South Carolina after the barrage of ads. But what explains Trump's pretty decisive victory in South Carolina over the weekend?
Well, South Carolina voters are channeling, anger, the South Carolina conservative voters. And let me say that this is not a something new. It's just something new nationwide. And let me back up to explain this strand of voting. Let me go all the way back to 2010. 2010, we had several white male establishment Republicans running for the governor's mansion of South Carolina, and then we had this complete unknown named Nikki Haley, and she had zero chance of winning. And partway through that primary, she got the endorsement of Sarah Palin, got a Tea Party bump, and she went from dead last in the polls to first, and she ended up winning the runoff and becoming governor. At that point, we realized in South Carolina, conservative voters were angry at the Republican establishment, and they were using the Tea Party as the vehicle to express that anger. Now, fast forward to 2012. The steadiest polling in South Carolina was for Mitt Romney. He was always second, and the person ahead of him the entire time was the insurgent, anti-Mitt Romney, anti-establishment candidate of the week, and that went from Santorum to Michelle Bachmann to Herman Cain, and it peaked around Newt Gingrich. And, South Carolina, whoever won the Republican primary in South Carolina had always gone on to get the nomination except for 2012. And everybody said, including me, that, we got it wrong. However, I really think that in 2012, we were the canary in the coal mine for the Republican establishment, and they missed the signal, and this is the result, this cycle where you're seeing that anger nationwide against the Republican establishment among conservative voters is the result, and it certainly was true here in South Carolina.
Well, that seems like it bodes well then for Donald Trump to keep on keeping on.
Well, I would say as long as he keeps up with his message, he will. I mean, polls, I just saw a poll out of Massachusetts showing Republican voters supporting him to the tune of 50%, which cracks the whole argument of he has a ceiling. Everybody assumes that every time he says something, that some folks deem outlandish, that while that may thrill his core supporters, that just tamps down his ceiling. And the fact is, that's still an operational theory, but we're not seeing evidence of that.
Scott, this is something that actually that Dick and I were talking about before going on the air, and it looks like Donald Trump won handily among white evangelicals in South Carolina. And, I don't know, are we Yankees up here, Dick? I don't even know. But let me just ask you straight out, why would an evangelical vote for Donald Trump?
Okay, first off, yes, you're Yankees, bless your heart, but that's okay.
Just checking.
Now, that said, first off, let's remember evangelicals are a very broad group, and so we are only talking about those evangelicals who are politicized enough to come and show up in the primary. And in South Carolina, everything is inundated with religion. 50% of the people go to church weekly or more. 75% of the people say religion is important to their lives. 78% of the people identify as Christians. So since we're the buckle of the Bible Belt, all you have to do is leap over the minimum bar and say, I'm a Christian, I believe in Christianity, and then they say, okay, well, what do I care about? And while, you know, they say, well, you know, he's thrice married and sometimes has a potty mouth, the fact is they want somebody who will fight for them because they feel marginalized, despite the fact that, you know, Christians are a majority in America and certainly in South Carolina. They feel that culture is hemming them in by forcing them to accept same-sex marriage, that conservatives aren't fighting on issues of abortion, that all of these things, that they are marginalized. In fact, in a poll of South Carolina likely Republican voters that we did back in December, we found significant numbers of them felt that whites were discriminated against. Trump supporters were very likely to say that whites were discriminated against as much or more than blacks. And huge numbers said that Christians were discriminated against. So they want an imperfect fighter. And there is a theological argument to it. God has always shown, chosen imperfect fighters. And evangelicalism is all about forgiveness and unearned grace. But the truth is, I think, more accurately, they want someone who will fight for them and put them back in their rightful place of having power. So they have this loss of efficacy, the sense that they matter, and they want a fighter to return them to that glory, and that Trump is the guy.
Well, and I'm looking at Dick, and I'm sure, John, you want to weigh in on this as well. Dick, let me go back to you just responding to what Scott said about the voters, the Christian evangelical voters in South Carolina going in a big way for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, what we were just right. I mean, the thing about same-sex marriage and abortion, if I know if it's important to the moral values of those voters, you know, I don't. I have a hard time remembering if Trump has even really addressed that issue. I would bet if you gave him sodium pentothal and it stuck, that he would say he couldn't care less whether gays are married or not. Never mind that he was going to stand against it, number one. Number two, on abortion, you know, he's still going back and forth on Planned Parenthood. You know, at one time he says, well, Planned Parenthood does a lot of – he keeps saying it does a lot of good things. You know, and then he sort of says, well, maybe they shouldn't get money for abortion, but they don't get money for abortion anyway because of the Hyde Amendment. So he's kind of in some ways, if you're really going to look at policy, he's soft on Planned Parenthood. So I keep coming back to this notion that – I mean, I'm going to actually paraphrase something I wrote yesterday
You're
morning.
You're allowed to do it. Go
Thank
ahead.
You. Yesterday morning after South Carolina voted, I kind of just basically said that, you know, that these, a lot of these voters don't care if Trump is trampling all their moral, you know, positions, and that even much of the time he traffics in incoherence. But I think for a lot of people, you know, they like his shtick because they are angry and they're fearful right now, also about terrorism, and they just want to smash the furniture and start over.
Well,
yeah, let me add.
You know what,
quickly,
Scott? Only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get you all three of you back in on the conversation, including you, John Brabender. We are talking about the GOP primary in South Carolina this past weekend. Also, have been talking about the caucuses in Nevada this past weekend as well. And again, Dick Pullman, national political columnist at NewsWorks. He writes the National Interest blog. John Brabender, a chief creative officer for Brabender Cox, that's a Republican consulting firm. And Scott Huffman, professor of political science at Winthrop University in South Carolina, director of the Winthrop Poll. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Scott Huffman, John Brabender, and Dick Pullman about the busy weekend for the 2016 presidential contenders, both in Nevada and in South Carolina. I know you want to say something, Scott, but let me get John Brabender back in on the conversation. And John, you had worked with Rick Santorum in his several bids for the White House. What do you make of Donald Trump's candidacy?
Well, I think what's important to note is the discussion that we were already having is critical and correct, that the precursor to this actually started in 2010. You did see places like, you know, I said Sharon Angle before, but also Christine O'Donnell in Delaware defeating Mike Castle in a primary. Things that no one would ever dream possible were symbolic that something was happening. And then in 2012, I did have a seat at the front row to watch this happen by being the top strategist on Rick Santorum's campaign, where Mitt Romney should have just gone in there. He was the overwhelming establishment candidate, had way more money than anybody else, and should have just breezed through the primary. Rick Santorum ended up winning 11 states. He actually won more counties throughout the country than Mitt Romney. And a lot of people wanted to say, oh, that must be the pro-life voters or the evangelical voters. Well, sure, that was a little part of it. But what we were seeing was that there was this whole blue-collar, middle-income voter who felt that they had been let down by both parties. They had been disenfranchised. Their voice no longer mattered. They felt people in Washington didn't understand their lives anymore. And they had remained silent to that point, and they started to speak up. Those are the people who now overwhelmingly are showing up for Donald Trump. And so I think it's you got to be careful when you say, well, yeah, he's doing well among some evangelicals. They're not just defined by their religion or faith. They're defined by their anger more than anything. And it's the whole paradox. Every time Donald Trump does something that we think is outrageous, it's just another clue to them that he's not another Washington politician. Mm. They may not even agree with what he says, but they believe he is somebody who, you know, I keep reminding people of the 70-something movie where called Network, where a TV announcer, you know, gets on the air and starts to yell, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And that became like this rallying cry for everybody. That's what Donald Trump is now for people. They're mad as all can be, and he's their megaphone, and they're just using him to amplify that, not only in Washington, but around this country.
Well, and I think one can understand the frustration and anger, but to you, Scott Huffman, what I personally struggle with Donald Trump is him, for instance, insulting John McCain and his 5 years as a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. And I know in South Carolina, that military, that's a really strong issue for people in that state. Can you wrestle with that one for us?
Well, you know, I think it's related back to what John was saying. It's anger. And let me, you know, explain how you can say things that you think would insult a core group, but enough of them will buy into you. So as Dick pointed out, he is not an evangelical on policy, but most people don't know policy, don't look at policy. At his rally on Saturday night, he was standing up saying, when I'm president, we're going to say Merry Christmas everywhere, and the crowd went wild. That's enough of a signal that, okay, he's not perfect, but, you know, we'll support him. And a lot of the blue-collar people who are going to turn out for the Republican primary, if they're religious, are more likely to identify as evangelical. So they're, as was pointed out, they are voting class a lot. They just happen to be evangelical when they turn out. And if he hits that minimum bar, they get to vote for this guy who's, you know, seemingly saying outrageous things, but that's what they think is needed. He comes down, and yes, he insulted John McCain, who did very well down here. But, you know, the same thing happened in 2000. In 2000, John McCain was running against George W. Bush for the nomination, and there were two whisper campaigns just destroying John McCain, and they succeeded. One of them was that, hey, he's the Manchurian candidate. He was a POW, and so he was brainwashed. He can't be trusted as president. And the other was showing a grainy photo of him holding a darker-skinned child saying, did you know John McCain had a black baby? Of course, he has an adoptive daughter from, I believe, Bangladesh. So, you know, it was okay for W. Bush to destroy a veteran because he said he's going to make America strong again, and the same thing is happening here. Donald Trump can, you know, diss John McCain and then turn and say, I'm going to make the American military stronger than it's ever been, and he taps into that anger, and it's seemingly okay.
Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, let me just add one other quick thing about Trump that we haven't hit on, and I think our other guests would probably agree with this, is that, you know, it's also the way he communicates. You know, he doesn't talk in political talk. You know, he doesn't have that kind of grammar. You know, he doesn't get up there and say, when I'm president, I promise to X. You know, he's got, like, you know, his whole verbal patter is sort of drawn from, you know, reality television, and they know him as a reality TV star. And so, you know, he's breaking all the rules of political talk. And for people who are really upset with politics per se, you know, that's extremely appealing. You can hear it in the visceral reaction. So I think it gives him, for better or worse, it gives him license to smash the China.
John, let me go back to you and the fact that Jeb Bush called it quits on Friday. This was he was never really able to have any traction this go round. He brought his mother in. He brought his brother into South Carolina. What do you make of the fact that Jeb Bush just never was able to find find support within the Republican Party. I think his supporters, or perhaps his team as well, spent something like $150 million. I think I have that right, and less than 100,000 votes that he got. So what should we make of Jeb?
Well, I think there are two problems. One is money doesn't matter as much in presidential elections as people think they do. They're really important in ballot races, Senate races, congressional races, but people get to see the candidates so much that being able to spend money isn't what it used to be. You get to still know the candidate. Second of all, I tweeted something last week about Jeb saying that campaigning with W, I think, just reinforces for everybody the reasons they're not voting for Jeb. And I got more retweets on that than anything I've ever tweeted, I think, in my life with people in agreement. The point is, I think it was a strategic mistake. First of all, it reminded people, do we really want another Bush? You know, it just had this sort of empire dynasty feel to it, which was not a good card for Jeb to play. Second of all, people kept looking at it and saying, wow, there's Jeb, there's George Bush. He looks really enthusiastic, energetic, and so forth. And then Jeb would come up, and it wasn't the same. And so I think those two factors together were certainly a Hail Mary, in a sense, by the Bush campaign. But I think, if anything, it probably backfired and hurt him in the end.
And, Scott, I have to say, as someone who, you know, obsessively watches all this stuff, I'm not exactly sure why sometimes, but I have to say that Jeb Bush, he just never looked like he was enjoying himself or that he was 100% committed to running for the White House.
Right. Well, he, you know, and of course that was tapped into early on by Trump, who labeled him low energy.
That's right.
And, you know, that kind of insult stuck because it seemed to have a little bit of truth in it. He seemed exasperated that the voter wasn't getting the fact that he was the best person for the job. You know, here he is running on saying, I know policy, I know these things the best, but he's not tapping into people's anger. He's trying to seem like the anti-Trump in a selection cycle where the angry Trump is exactly what people want. And John's absolutely right. When you are trying to win an election in a cycle that is anti-establishment, when your last name is Bush, that's tough enough. But the last thing you should do is bring in your brother, who exemplifies the Republican establishment as the last Republican president. It was, you know, the action of somebody who's desperate, but it had no chance of working because it played into what everybody was essentially mad at to begin with.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I was going to say about the timing. You know, I'm talking about the wrong candidate for the wrong year. Jeb's timing really started to go wrong in 1994 when he lost his gubernatorial race in Florida. And his brother was running in Texas, and he was expected to lose. Jeb was expected to win. Instead, the reverse happened. You know, Jeb was expected to win, and he was the smart one, right? And then he was going to, you know, be set up to run once Bill Clinton got out of office. And it didn't happen that way. And so by the time he got around to it, you know, he hit the wrong year. And I think, he was too polite. He was too polite for this cycle. You know, I've seen these interviews where these voters say, you know, I can't really go for Jeb. I just don't see the fire. I just wish he had showed more fire, you know, because, again, it's that visceral feeling they had.
And that's Dick Pullman, who joins us along with John Brabender and Scott Huffman. We're talking about what happened this past weekend, the GOP South Carolina presidential primary and the Democratic Nevada caucuses, Hillary Clinton winning in Nevada and Donald Trump winning in South Carolina. 1-888-477-9499. Dick, I have an email from Roy who says, I can't let the comment by Pullman stand that Clinton won the Hispanic vote in Nevada when the polling shows different. And I've seen some mixed polling on this. He linked to a Washington Post piece.
Yeah. And the New York Times had a good analysis over the weekend that was wrong, that's wrong in the exit polls. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense that Bernie wins the Hispanic vote by eight points is what the exit poll said. And the New York Times had a really good analysis where they actually went in and they looked neighborhood by neighborhood in the heaviest precincts in Clark County, which is Las Vegas, the heaviest Hispanic neighborhoods. And they were pulling out Hillary getting more than 60% of those voters. And they have a long analysis, which we don't need to get into on the radio, about how the exit poll system was not really set up to sample such a small number of Hispanics. It was something like 200 that they sampled. So, you know, I think the fact that she won the non-white vote, I think is kind of speaks for itself, and I think it's going to set her up well for down the road.
A tweet from Walt.
One other thing about Nevada is it's really about organization. I mean, the biggest difference between her campaign and Bernie Sanders is his is a movement, hers is a campaign. And so if you look at Nevada, they got all the casino – Clinton got all the casino workers organized, all those types of things. It shows why she can move from state to state and be competitive everywhere, and he can't.
Let me read a tweet from Walt. He says, Sanders is leading in all the polls against Republicans. Why do people keep saying Hillary is more electable? Scott, I'm sure you've wrestled with this. What do you say to Walt?
Well, the truth is national polls just mean nothing at this point. We don't have an electorate or we don't have an election right now that is actually pitting these two people against each other. And so, you know, you're seeing a lot of anti-Trump people just basically saying whoever's running against them. But whether or not that translates into something nationally is an entirely different question. You know, they're picking hypothetical matchups that don't exist, but in concrete matchups, Hillary is beating Bernie in the contest that matters right now, and that's the Democratic primaries and caucuses. Although Bernie had at least one massive win, and I think Hillary is seeking to have that big or bigger win in South Carolina to reclaim the narrative. But you know, the fact is a lot of the people just aren't that familiar with Bernie Sanders nationally. Yes, those who are passionate about the Democratic primary, those who, you know, listen to your show are simply more informed than the average person. And so anybody who's polled who is not a likely primary voter but may be deemed a likely general election voter this far out, which is an imprecise science to say the least this far out, you know, they're hearing Donald Trump versus someone else. I'll take the someone else. And that doesn't mean that they know a thing about Bernie Sanders. It really says more about Trump than anything.
John, let me go back to you and throw out the name Marco Rubio. And I'm going to quote some things that Dick Pullman wrote in his piece in the last couple of days about Marco Rubio. Is he the sort of golden boy among the, if I can put it that, it's a terrible thing to say, the golden candidate going forward for, you think, the mainstream Republican Party?
Well, I think he has the best chance of winning in November, that's for sure, because what he does is he's certainly acceptable to multiple wings of the Republican Party, if you will. Social conservatives like him, reformers like him. They still see him enough as an outsider, but he's also a great American story as well, and the establishment like him. And so I think he offers the best contrast. I have seen within Republican circles, there's been a number of studies done already that looked at the top three candidates and said, well, how will that affect us in down ballot races, Senate races, congressional races? And what they found was Ted Cruz probably hurts us more than helps us. Trump does okay because he does bring a new voter. But the candidate that actually helps Republicans all the way up and down the ballot, if you will, is Marco Rubio. So I do think you're going to see the anybody but Trump and Cruz coalition quickly unite behind Rubio at this point.
And, Dick, you call him a callow freshman senator.
Well, I call him callow in the sense that I don't see what he has in terms of any kind of, you know, measurable achievements. Whether that matters or not, I don't know. You know, he can, like John said, you know, I think he's good at telling a story of his campaign. Narrative is really important for a candidate, particularly in this kind of environment. I think the thing that he might have to worry about is there's another Republican debate. I believe it's Thursday night, believe it or not, everybody. And it'd be very interesting to see how Trump handles him. I think, you know, Trump was mocking him at a recent rally, saying that he was sweating so much standing next to him that he thought he was next to a swimming pool. So who knows what he's going to do with him. I think the one of the dangers is that if all the sort of establishment people and the donors start coalescing around Rubio, which I think is quite likely and is probably already happening, of course, post Jeb, that Trump could use that as a foil and say, well, okay, you see, here's where the, you know, he's the stalking horse for the party establishment, and use that to his advantage.
Scott, what's interesting, of course, is that Nikki Haley endorsed Marco Rubio, as did Senator Tim Scott. He hasn't yet won officially either a caucus or a primary. Did that help him, even though he didn't win in South Carolina? Did that help him?
Well, let's dispel the notion that Marco Rubio doesn't know what he's doing. He knows exactly what – I'm sorry, I couldn't get through without throwing that one in there.
Fair enough.
Actually, it does, and let me explain why. That's not only an endorsement from the establishment. It's an endorsement from real conservatives. Nikki Haley, in the response to President Obama's State of the Union address, came across as kind of a moderate. She's not. She is very conservative. She won with Tea Party support. In South Carolina, she's considered extremely conservative. Tim Scott propelled to being the first elected African-American to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina ever, and the first African-American to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina since Reconstruction. And Trey Gowdy, of course, is the Tea Party favorite Republican who went after Hillary Clinton in the Benghazi hearings. So this not only gives him the veneer of an establishment candidate, it also kind of reinforces his credentials as a conservative, and he is a conservative. You look at the American Conservative Union scores, Marco Rubio has a lifetime ACU score of 98. Now, Ted Cruz has a lifetime ACU score of 100, American Conservative Union. So it does, those endorsements do help him on two levels.
Let's hold on to that thought, Dick, only because we have to take another short break. And again, we are talking about what happened this weekend in South Carolina, the Republican presidential primary, Donald Trump walking away with another win, and the Democratic Nevada caucuses, which Hillary Clinton won. Talking with Scott Huffman, the voice you just heard, also John Brabender and Dick Pullman. And we've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email. RadioTimes@WHYY.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I'll read some of that after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with John Brabender, the Chief Creative Officer for Brabender Cox at the Republican consulting firm. Scott Huffman, political science professor at Winthrop University in South Carolina, director of the Winthrop Poll, and Dick Pullman, who writes the National Interest blog for WHYY's newsworks.org. Dick, you wanted to say something quickly, and then I'll read some comments here.
Oh, yeah, very quickly. And this goes back to the caller who was saying, well, what about all these polls which show that Bernie is stronger against the Republicans than Hillary is? You know, the simple answer to that is it's a totally asymmetrical situation. Hillary's been pounded for a quarter of a century, and Bernie has barely, by the Republicans and conservatives, and Bernie's barely been touched. You can rest assured that they probably is a 5-inch thick opposition research document being compiled right now on the Republican side about Bernie if they ever had to use it. And the thing that I think of more than anything is in 2004, the Democrats picked John Kerry to run because they thought, oh, here's a guy with multiple medals of honor in Vietnam, et cetera. You know, they can't possibly knock him down as being strong on defense. And he came out at the convention and said, I'm reporting for duty with a salute. And then they turned around and ran right at that. And they with Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, so-called. And that was the end of that.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine that. With Bernie, it's probably just as bad. He's a little bit, wobbly on foreign policy and national security. That's not his issue. You get into a general election. National security is a big issue in a general election. And I think that's where they would run right at him. And I think those polls would change.
Here's an email from Mike, speaking to what you were just saying there, Dick. He says, let's say hypothetically that Bernie beats Hillary. Would the GOP need anything more for campaign ads and a picture of Bernie with a quote, I am a socialist, to mop the floor with him?
Mm-hmm.
A tweet from Nate, what indicators do we have as to how Trump will fare against Clinton? Is a general election win actually possible? Scott, is it too soon, too early to imagine a Trump versus Clinton national election?
Well, you know, it's a little early to poll for it. You know, that's not going to stop anybody from doing exactly that. But even after they get the nominations, you know, there will be some flux in picking out likely voters. And that, of course, is one of the issues that good polling faces, is how to correctly identify likely voters. But because Hillary is a known, you know, established Democrat and Trump is going to be running as a Republican, we can look to the normal vote. You know, the concept of the normal vote is all Democrats vote Democrat, all Republicans vote Republican, nobody crosses over, and the independents are evenly split. If that happens nationally and the Democrats turn out their base, they win, because there are more people nationally who identify as Democrats. You know, the question becomes also, Hillary would have a chance at getting Florida and Virginia. And here's the thing about the Electoral College. The Republicans, you know, really want to sweep the South, the 11 state South. If you sweep the 11 state South, you have 59% of all the Electoral College votes that you need to become president, and you need less than 30% of the entire rest of the country. Mm. But the Democrats, if the Democrats crack the South with two states, they become president. Hillary will have a shot to do that with Florida and Virginia. And, you know, under a normal vote, Hillary wins unless her base is just sort of lackluster and fails to turn out.
And there is a question sometimes, Scott, with Democrats and turnout compared to yep. Republicans.
Absolutely. Democrats are less likely to turn out, which is why, you know, you see elections where if the Democrats can't turn out their entire base, Republicans, simply by the fact that they tend to turn out in higher numbers, are going to beat them every time. So, you know, the old adage is, you know, it's turnout that matters, is simply absolutely, positively true. Elections are rarely, sometimes, but rarely won on what the independents do. Independents only make up 9% of the American population, and I'm counting people who say, I'm an independent, but lean Democrat as Democrats and vice versa. So they're less engaged, they're less likely to turn out, and the truth is they rarely are the deciding factor in elections. It is all about turnout, and Democrats have a steeper hill to climb than Republicans on that.
John, let me turn to you, and then we'll get back to some callers and some more comments here. Help us understand, and this seems to be pretty universal. I've talked to a number of Republicans about this. Republicans don't like Ted Cruz. What is the issue here? What is the problem here?
Well, it's very simple. He doesn't play well with others. And, you know, you can be a reformer and go right into, you know, the lion's den, so to speak, but still have relationships and get along. And I think the problem is they feel a lot about what Ted Cruz is somebody who just wants to tear everything down and really has no plan for building it back up. So they're very fearful of him. You know, the irony, if you will, is I'm finding in a lot of circles, people have warmed to Donald Trump because they don't want Ted Cruz.
Wow.
And they actually look at Ted Cruz as you know, the larger evil, if you will. I think they also are worried that his sort of caustic nature will turn off a lot of voters in the general election. I think what they're really looking at are what we used to call Reagan Democrats that are in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, that Republicans used to get when they won presidential races, but we haven't been getting. They couldn't vote for Romney, particularly after the 47% comment. Well, some of them will vote for a Trump. Some of them will vote for a Rubio, but it's unlikely that they're going to vote for a Cruz. And I think that has a lot of people within the Republican Party very worried.
Interesting. I mean, wondering whether National Review will have a cover story about Ted Cruz. Let me get David from Central New Jersey to join us. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
We need to get rid of that. And I think my mic is off.
Everybody, particularly, I believe he's astonished everybody because he's amazingly popular for the most simple reasons of all.
And you're talking about Donald Trump. Sorry, David. We missed the very beginning of your comment.
I'm sorry. I believe that the reason Donald Trump has astonished the country and many of the most sophisticated observers of all is because he's popular for the simplest reasons of all. It's very primal. It's self versus not self. People look at him and they say, and if you look at his supporters, I think this is true physically, he looks like me. His face looks like my face. His face looks like my father's, my grandfather's, my uncle's. He talks like the people I remember growing up as a kid who were spontaneous, totally confident, unrehearsed, not afraid to fight back in any way that they believed was appropriate. And it's that very direct, almost biological link that people have that is going to carry him and continue to carry him. And
right,
nobody
David.
Counted on that.
Well, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to quote Dick Pullman again.
Uh-oh.
You describe Ted Cruz as a xenophobic, hate-peddling vulgarian whose sole agenda is himself.
Oh,
which
Trump.
Is not true. We all know he's Canadian, so that's already
no. Isn't that the way I describe Trump?
Trump, exactly.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, going back to what the caller was saying. Yeah, there's a lot of people who identify him with him that way. The problem is, there's also a lot of people in this country who are African American and Hispanic and Muslim American, and let's not forget that. And I don't know how many of those are going to turn out and be excited by him. And what Hillary Clinton has to do in the fall, if it comes down to the two of them, is that and she has, I think, quite a lot of potential for doing this, is to basically say, look at the stuff that this guy is saying. You know, is there room for them in Donald Trump's vision of America? And it so happens that Hispanic, you know, we're talking electoral college. It's a 50-state election. And Hispanics have been virtually pivotal in the last few cycles in states like Nevada, Colorado, Virginia and Florida, which we've referenced. New Mexico is another one I can think of. And I can't help thinking that that's the way that she can build a winning campaign.
And John, I'm not sure whether it was Barack Obama's first win or second win, didn't the Republican Party do some soul searching saying, you know, we need to be more diverse, we need to be more inclusive, we need to be more welcoming to people that may not have a natural inclination to join the Republican Party or vote for a Republican candidate?
Yeah, but there's a distinction between saying that and let's all of a sudden all become Democrats, which is what I think a lot of people thought we were going to do, is give up our core values, which I think would be a mistake. Second of all, I think we're greatly oversimplifying Hillary Clinton. I mean, let's be honest. She should not be having this type of struggle in her own primary. There was supposed to be a coronation. What this clearly shows is there are a lot of questions regarding Hillary. People on both sides of the aisle are worried about character issues, or she would be doing better. So I think it's very hard to say if the race runs true to form, here's how it's going to be, because you don't have true to form candidates anymore. And so I think this is going to be a very difficult general election on both sides, and I don't think there's any obvious path for anyone.
Do you agree with that, Scott? And even looking ahead to the weekend when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will be in South Carolina, she certainly has some of her own baggage, it seems.
Right. And, you know, and she'll do very strongly in South Carolina. But I think the point's well made that, you know, she's got a lot of things thrown at her, which is why I argued even before the process started that this shouldn't be a coronation for her. It would be better if somebody gave her a run for her money. I never thought it would be a Vermont Socialist, but it would be better for her so that, you know, she would be a little battle tested. People would have heard this stuff in the primary, and that would blunt its impact a little bit in the general election. Among people who say, you know, honesty matters, she's not doing as well. Among people who say competence matters, she's, you know, beating Bernie Sanders. So basically, in the general election, I can foresee exactly, what was just mentioned about, you know, do we want somebody with this character as the, you know, commander in chief? And the flip side, that do you want somebody who has this vision of America as your president? And that's how they're going to, you know, hurtle insults at each other.
And Dick, you want to weigh in on this at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, I agree. I think what's happening on the Democratic side, at least what I saw in Nevada in terms of the exit polls, was when you asked voters what were the most important factors that go into your vote, there was a plurality of 27% that said, well, having the right experience is the most important thing. And she got something like 92%, and I think Bernie got the rest. And yet when you asked about if honesty was the most important factor, Bernie wiped the floor with Hillary. So, you know, it almost makes the question as well, you know, you know, do we expect perhaps our presidents to be a tad devious? You know, do you make peace with that to some extent? I mean, I don't want to sound too cynical here, but if you actually look at, if you read up on Franklin D. Roosevelt, who's considered one of our greatest presidents, and the guy was like extremely devious. You know, you can see it in all the best biographies. You know, so I mean, this is kind of like the reality of what power is. You know, so you don't have the you don't have a perfect candidate.
Let me see what Michael from looks like Gloucester City, New Jersey has to say. Michael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great to be on the show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to know, you know, I'm politically active, but I have no idea what the superdelegates mean as far as the caucuses are concerned. And I wanted to know what impact they'll have and why they have the power that they have. In this election, both for the Democrats and the Republicans. And I'll take the answer off the air.
Absolutely, Michael. I chuckled only because we've been talking. We're going to do a whole show about how our system actually works. But Dick raised his hand,
saying he wants
to respond.
I guess I only raised my hand like I'm in class because I did a whole column about what they are. And this is a Democratic construct, the superdelegates. And they were created sometime in the early 1980s because the party didn't want, they were still sort of upset about the George McGovern wipeout in 1972. And they wanted to have sort of a check and balance against sort of a runaway insurgent who might lead the party to disaster. So they basically said, let's have delegates who are comprised of, the sort of so-called wise people in the party, office holders, governors, party leaders, congressmen, you know, who would sort of, you know, maybe have steady the ship if it needed. And so they can vote superdelegates. They're in every state and they can vote however they want. They are not tied to the results of the primaries and caucuses. And so Hillary Clinton, because she has such a long history with so many of these people and has worked in the party, by the way, whereas Bernie Sanders only caucuses with the party. She has a bond with a lot of these superdelegates, and there's something like 15 or 20% of all the delegates.
Wow.
Now, having said that, it's very unlikely that they would go against the wishes of the primary electorate in the end. In 2008, they started out being strongly for Hillary, but after Barack Obama got ahead and stayed ahead, he started peeling them away.
We're almost out of time here. And, Scott, I see both on my phone screen and also screens with email comments and tweets a number of references to Germany in the 1930s. And it's not the first time I've seen this. What and people are saying that they see, frankly, Donald Trump as having and perhaps this time having some of the same characteristics. I'd be curious about your response.
Well, you know, Godwin's law just kicks in. You know, how long does the internet discussion go until Hitler's mentioned?
Exactly.
And you know, I was on Al Jazeera America this morning, and the anchor 8 raised that question twice, saying, "Isn't this, you know, kind of like Hitler's rise in Germany?" And the truth is, yes, there are some concerning things. You see a lot of xenophobia, a lot of nationalism. I don't believe that we're seeing a doomsday scenario because we are a democratic republic in a very different way. But the rhetoric inciting people against the outsider is not unfamiliar, but it's also not the first time that this has happened, you know, in America. You got to remember, one of the things this country was founded on was anti-Catholicism. And so strains like that have run throughout our history. The Know Nothing Party was adamantly in favor of just keeping out all foreigners, Catholic and otherwise as well, later on in our country's history. So this is not new to us. It's not new in history. But yes, there's absolutely a strain of xenophobia and nationalism in it.
Well, on that note, we do have to end our discussion. I can see we could have carried on certainly another hour. My thanks to all three of you for joining us. Scott Huffman, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Political Science at Winthrop University, Director of the Winthrop Poll, that's in South Carolina. John Brabender, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the Chief Creative Officer for Brabender Cox. That's a Republican consulting firm. And Dick Pullman, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. A national political columnist for Newsworks. He writes the National Interest blog. Also full-time writer-in-residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.